This is Improvised Radio Theatre with Dice, with me, Michael Kuehl.
And me, Roger Bell West.
And this is our extra special summer specials seaside supplement. We're off on our holidays.
Girls got my ships.
You didn't
think Cheltenham was a coastal town, did you? But it's infested with gulls.
Everywhere is infested with gulls. It's worse in the winter when they try to get away from the cold ocean. Though Dublin, let me just say in passing, has a species of malicious gull all of its own.
Heh.
And I was there for the Worldcon, and I'll be at the Worldcon in Glasgow in August, if any of our listeners care to look me up. But what we were going to say was, well, this time we're going to talk about a season, a brief season of Blades in the Dark that I ran for Roger and some of our friends over a few months, and the successes and failures, what went well and what went badly, and generally how we feel about this. And we hope this is going to keep you fascinated for the summer and bring you back again when we restart in the autumn. There is, I should probably mention at this moment, an offer which is going to fade in a couple of days after this first goes online. So if you're doing this, listen to this after the first couple of days in August, you aren't going to be, you're going to be annoyed with me and annoyed with the offerers. This isn't the bundle of holding. This is the humble bundle. And they are currently offering at a very reasonable price PDFs of the entire line of RuneQuest Adventures in Glorantha, which is Chaosium's latest version of the system, and which I will be running for Roger and the same group of friends over the next few months. So
once that's done, we'll probably come back and talk about it. But by then, it'll be too late to go all in if you want at this extremely cheap price. I should say, by the way, they haven't sent us a freebie on this because they
so
don't.
We're doing this out of the goodness of our hearts. We are, but we think you ought to know. We think you ought to know about it. And it's a very good modern version of a classic game. And there are all the supplements. There's the starter set. There's all the adventures, and I think all of the cults books that have been so far published, with maybe the exception of the Lunar Cults, but there's everything you could need and more to start a Glorantha campaign in this offer, and you should take advantage.
There's even the RuneQuest colouring book. I mean, how can you say no to that?
I didn't know about the colouring book. Oh dear. Anyway, if we have no more to say of an introductory nature, onwards. This is the first in a series which I suspect will become known as What We Did Over Our Summer Holidays. This is about Blades in the Dark, the first of the Forged in the Dark spin-offs from, I think we can argue, this is a spin-off from Powered and the Apocalypse stories.
I think it's slightly more hierarchical than that. I mean, this is derived from Powered by the Apocalypse, yes, though it changes quite a bit about it. It's not a PBTA game.
No.
And then all the Forged in the Dark stuff spins off from this.
Yeah. Well, that's what I was trying to say. This is the prototype. I think you can see it. You can see the Powered by the Apocalypse in the rule that mostly only the player's role, and it's the consequence of the player's actions that a player's success or failure.
Yeah, it doesn't feel like PBTA games that I have played, but yes, I absolutely agree that you can see some of the rules elements to it. I'll come back to that, in fact, later on. But,
okay, I was going to point out that it starts It also incorporates play sheets for characters and for the organisations, which is definitely Powered by the Apocalypse derived.
Yeah, though what it doesn't have that, to me, is the key thing of PBTA is moves. I mean, yeah, there are things you can do, but there are not the things that... You do not have a unique set of things that only you can do being the entire set of things your character can do, which is, I think, what a pure PBTA game does.
You do have... Let's take a step back.
Anyway,
we're in the weeds already.
We played it. Mike ran it. I played it. I'm a grumpy player. There were also other grumpy players.
I think I have achieved on this occasion total party grump. Although some of them were.
We are a party of curmudgeons, sir.
Yeah, well, it's true. It's true. So, not all of you are as old as I am, either.
So I think the short version is we didn't love it, though I at least found it jolly interesting.
Yeah.
That means it's bad, overall, or B, for anybody else, frankly, I don't want to say. I mean, what I think we're going to try to do here is say what worked and didn't work for us.
Yeah.
And if that aligns with you, then this may be helpful. And if that is the opposite of what you want, then this may be helpful, so...
Okay, let's try a description of it first. I think it's fair to say that it's trying to be The Lies of Locke Lamorna. I've not finished that book, by the way. The Lies of Locke Lamorna, the role-playing game. It is... It is a set in a dark fantasy universe, and a doomed dark fantasy universe, in point of fact. And you are criminals, thieves, lowlifes, attempting to climb up the ladder of criminal organisations to have more respect. You've got to have respect. If you don't have respect, you don't have anything.
I think you're pronouncing it wrong. It's respect.
Respect. Is that a glottal stop in the middle you're trying for, or what?
No, it's a sort of glottal stop at the end, really. Anyway.
All right, so setting first, you're in Duskval, which is a port city in a world where the sun went out several generations ago.
But nobody seems to mind, at least not at the level you're at.
Well, you've got used to the fact you've got nothing to eat but rats and mushrooms by now. And you have the glories of modern arcane tech protecting you from the howling wastes outside the city, and you don't worry about the difficulty of finding more leviathans to provide the only source of energy that your culture seems to know about. The place is haunted. There are ghosts about. And ghosts appear to power a lot of the tech. Everybody in the city appears to be corrupt, to a first approximation. And the lawful authorities and the rich people, just as much as the lowlifes like you. As far as I can tell, there aren't any nice people in the city, or maybe in the entire world.
Or if there are, you're them. I mean, I think this is trying to offer a reasonably wide range of noir in the sense that, yeah, the authorities are corrupt and you're not going to get out of this clean, but you can try to be the one man who is not, what is it,
neither dishonest nor afraid.
Yeah.
That one.
You can try to be that guy. You won't have an easy job of it, but it's a thing you can do, or you can just be out for yourself.
Well, the game mechanics lean towards you becoming the victim of post-traumatic stress disorder, and eventually becoming either so physically, mentally, or morally corrupt that you have to stop playing and hope you've got enough money from thieving other people to save for your retirement. There is actually a rating on what sort of really nice retirement home your personal stash is going to get you. And you are part of a crew of villains, which is your corporate identity. You have a territory which you're trying to make your own. You have a hideout. You have a reputation. And you also have a certain amount of heat and perhaps wanted posters associated with your name. So you are there and you are trying to do, heists, jobs,
capers.
And basically the structure of the cycle of the game, it's got a cycle, for a reason I'll come back to, is the GM creates or proposes a job you can do. A person comes to you or you spot an opportunity and you have a basic description of the valuable shipment and where it's going to land, or the person who has collected a certain sort of goods in their house, or the people who could be beaten up for money and thrown into the streets.
Depending on type of gang, the sort of thing you do, and so on.
You're all free to do any sort of criminal or even semi-legal activity. But your crew, your gang, has specialised abilities which will make certain jobs easier for you. And if you do the sort of job you're built for in your own territory, then you get further bonuses. The system... first of all, there is an information gathering phase, and then there is what's called the engagement role. Once you've gathered all the information you can, once you've got all the advantages you have, and once you've figured out what your approach to getting in and doing the job is going to be, you make a role for how well your team does. This is an abstract role, but it sets you up for the first in-character moment, and the moment at which you're on top of the roof, having jumped across from the next-door building, or you're knocking on the door and saying you've come to clean the chimneys, or you're invoking a passage through the ghostlands in order to get to... the cellar of the place you're going to rob. We did that once in a campaign I was in, and it was really run very well, very weird. You make a role against the abstract planning you've just done, and then you see how well you've done. Now, the universal resolution system is, whether it's you as an individual or the team as a whole, you gather a pool of D6s. If you roll 1 to 3, you failed. I'm sorry, you go by the highest result. If you roll 1 to 3, is your highest result, you failed and bad stuff is about to happen to you. You roll 4 or 5, you succeeded, but there are going to be complications later on. You roll a 6, and you've succeeded completely. You roll more than 1 6. That's a critical, and you're doing ludicrously well.
Yeah, and this is another thing Powered by the Apocalypse does, that whole failure, success with a cost, or quite rarely, total success. I mean, it's optimised for success with a cost. Usual thing you're going to do if you're vaguely competent but not supreme.
Yeah, because obviously there's going to be... It's much more exciting to watch the players stumble through the bits that hasn't been mapped, knocking things over occasionally and attracting attention. It's much more exciting to watch a ticking clock, and the game provides a mechanism it calls a clock, which basically are steps in which something good or something is achieved or something bad is up, come up to.
Look how clever we are. We invented the idea of having 4 tick boxes, and when you run out of tick boxes, then the thing happens. The thing that really very much strikes me from having played it is this is not, I mean, we've talked before about the emergent narratives of role-playing games, and this is a game that does not really care about those. What it wants to be is, well, quite possibly the Eyes of Loch Lomoro. The thing that really struck me was it wants to be Ocean's 11, the 2001 remake.
Yeah, it's a caper movie.
Specifically, it wants to, like a lot of caper films, it wants to show you these guys are planning, they're smart. And then it wants to jump to the action and let's ignore the bit where their plans worked because that worked. That's not exciting. So let's jump straight to the bit where their plans didn't work and now they have to be awesome and improvise their way around something. Yeah, fair enough. The thing is, I have also seen Ocean's 11 1960. And it when I saw the later film, it really struck me what the contrast was because in the 1960 original, they are all old war buddies who basically got bored with peace and their lives have gone in variously not great directions.
Yeah.
But they are all old buddies. They all trust each other. These are the guys who fought their way up Italy and any crew member knows that any other crew member's got his back. And that is, it's not stated explicitly, but it's strongly implied and obviously to the audience at the time, many of whom would have done the same thing or at least known people who did. You know, that is a thing you can assume given that background. Ocean's 11 2001 doesn't do that. They don't have old friendships, except the two leads just about. They don't have their old in-jokes. They are all individually recruited by the boss, Ocean.
So this is...
They
this
have
is,
no reason to trust each other. They're just thrown into this thing, and there's this big sign saying, these guys are player characters, therefore they trust each other.
Yeah, they are... But do they functionally trust each other? And if so, why?
That's the thing. They seem to have all these disparate backgrounds. There's the implication that everybody trusts Danny because they've each individually worked with him before, and therefore it is transitive that they will trust anybody else that he recruited. But it just doesn't feel like the team of people who've been through hell together that the original had.
I was getting the
same feeling here. Similarly to the 2001 film, Blades wants to say, okay, skip all that boring stuff. We're going to jump to the bit where somebody gets to be awesome.
I think that's probably true.
But it wants to elide the details that say, well, here is why this situation has arisen. Don't ask silly questions like that. Here's a situation. Do something.
Okay, that is the emergent narrative.
Well, that's the thing. It doesn't have the emergent narrative because there's no background for the narrative to emerge from, because there isn't the thing we did in the previous room, because the thing we did in the previous room has been elided in our what was it called?
Engagement role.
Engagement role, thank you. So what we get is lots of little episodes in which we can do well or we can do badly, but they don't really seem to link together for me. I was very much reminded. Did you ever read D&D 4th edition, the one everybody hated?
No, I haven't read anything D&D since 1979.
Probably very wise. Actual role playing got about three paragraphs in that book, or those books. And it was basically saying, you can do a silly accents. If you're a dwarf, you should talk about beer and axes a lot, that kind of thing.
I'm running Dungeon Fantasy, which is as near a purely tactical game as you're going to get. But my players, being old players, still role play, still play the character disadvantages for all it's worth, and still bicker at each other.
And similarly, did you ever play the Arkham Horror board game? Any of its incarnations?
I think I did, yeah.
And so with that, it is a purely mechanical exercise as published, and it would be a very boring purely mechanical exercise if you didn't do the occasional silly voice or say, after your hobo character has failed to investigate something and say, oh, well, maybe I won't look in there, maybe I'll just look down the bottom of this bottle of bootleg gin instead, that kind of thing.
Another thing that is...
But it's incidental.
Yeah. Another thing that's purely mechanical, and nobody would play it if it didn't have the role-playing aspects, would be Tales of the Arabian Nights.
Yeah.
Where you're not even playing your character on the same continent most of the time. You're shuffling about the Mediterranean and the Arabic world, and you're trying to be Aladdin while somebody over there is trying to be Sinbad the Sailor. But it's still fun, and people spend hours doing it. All right, this.
Just to come out of this, because what this game is setting up to do is give you lots of little prompts where you can come up with a clever thing to say and be awesome with it. There was one occasion in the game in which I think I got this right, which is we are making our getaway from a place that we've established is Canal Side.
Yeah.
And so I think, aha, I have some preparation that I haven't yet expended, or was it stress or whatever, but anyway.
Stress, yeah.
I will borrow the mayor's state barge and my mate is going to turn up with it at the right moment. And we will make our escape in a very slow and formal manner, because, I mean, who would question the mayor's state barge? That I think, is what it's trying to do. It wants me to invent stuff like that on the spur of the moment. And if you have players who are constantly up for inventing stuff like that, I think it would work much better than it did with, frankly, us.
I don't think it's a lack of... you're talking about the flashback mechanism. You say it's not quite at the level of Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey, but you do get to say, I have prepared for precisely this moment, and here is your bribe, Inspector. Please go away now.
Yeah, I mean, what that's trying to do, obviously, is get away from the planning scene where the players, more or less in character, take ages trying to work out every possible option and account for it.
And aren't you glad it does, because the planning scene is tedious?
No.
All right, okay.
If I wanted a game that had the story beats of a film or a book, yes, that would be great, because that's what you get in a film or a book. Games have their own story form, and they don't need this sort of beat to be satisfying. It is sometimes great fun to have a really comprehensive planning session, and then it works because you accounted for the things. That is fun in itself. It would be very boring if you just read about it, but when you're doing it, it can be great. This is not a game that wants to support that. That's fine, you know. That's the thing I like doing, so...
All right, I'm trying to think of a system that would hum. I'm trying to think of a system that would allow you to have your planning session and not burden the GM with having to specify to the depth of that you would need.
Oh, I wrote one of these. It's in one of the Pyramid Volume 3 issues. Basically, you use your skills and contacts and so on to build up essentially flavored planning points. So you have a whole bunch of technical planning points, and somebody else has a whole bunch of social planning points, and they then spend those during the job to overcome obstacles. And it is done similarly with that flashback mechanism. I mean, that's fine. I mean, yeah, obviously, Blades is not the first game to do this, and it won't be the last. But even with that one that I wrote, it can be unsatisfying because it feels like a resource management game, like early D&D going down a dungeon, and it doesn't feel so much like role-playing.
Well, I think that sort of abstraction is difficult. Maybe you need to combine something like the rules of Dungeon with a J, in which I think was the first game in which the GM said, all right, if you want it to be there, it's there. Now what are you going to do with it? And I think that allowing the players to specify what sort of castle they think the evil overlord is hiding in, as long as it's sufficiently powerful to be a challenge to their skills, then I think that might possibly work. But I would want to engage some of the bits of things like Blades in the Dark, which I think work, to contain that as well. I tell you what I think is the main problem with Blades in the Dark, apart from the gloomy setting, and the fact you start out as basically a street scum looked down upon by everybody. Just about everybody in the city is more powerful than you are.
Well, let me just go in there very briefly, which is, I've got no problem with we start out a bit rubbish. But it doesn't work when the system requires you to be flashy and daring and risk terrible failure. Because if you're a bit rubbish, you try to be a bit cautious.
Well, if you're a bit rubbish, yeah, you're not going. No matter how flashy you get, you're not going to get the critical results on what you have left to roll.
But the game requires you to be flashy in order to make any progress.
Well, it requires you to be flashy and obvious, I think, sometimes, in order to make the reputation of your crew. But I was going to say that the thing that strikes me as being the major downer for this style of game is the fact that each role, and yes, you shouldn't roll as often as I did, probably, but each role for each significant development, I has to go through a ritual of saying, what are the circumstances? Are they controlled, risky, or desperate? And desperate earns you experience ticks on each attempt in desperate circumstances. And will the result be less than average, average, or great?
Yeah,
and that set of thinking about it and answering the questions and assigning extra bonus dice and factors that increase the effect. That is a killer.
This was, I think, not helped by the fact that we had to intermediate it all through Roll 20.
All right, that was my decision.
Which has this complicated... Basically, the particular... I mean, this is not a thing about Roll 20 in general, but as it was, we would have to click on the thing that we were rolling, fair enough, and then answer individual questions of position and effect level and bonus, and for each of those, if you turned out to have clicked the wrong thing, then you had to abandon the whole thing and start again. And this felt mechanistic, which obviously it is.
I got to say, I'm going to say, the Roll 20, though it added a few difficulties, was useful to me from the point of view of record keeping. And I'm going to come back to record keeping on another bit, which I think.
Well, there was one record I would have wanted it to keep, which is tick my thingy whenever I make a desperate roll, but it doesn't do that.
Yeah.
But
you would have, let me finish, Roger, you would have had the same slowing down effect if we'd been just rolling dice off screen, because you have to go to the GM and say, is it this, is it that?
Yeah, it's extra friction. I mean, one of the things that's doing here is the same thing that 7th C First Edition does, which is essentially remove some degree of the GM's freedom. The GM has to set a difficulty level and say, you must get this, you must roll this well to succeed. But if you roll this well, you will succeed. And
yeah. Obviously any system
what you can't do is the thing that I've quite often done in GURPS of say, okay, make a roll. I have a vague modifier in mind that say I think this guy's about a -3. So, you know, if you roll a -6, then great. Yeah, if you roll that well. If you just barely pass, well, no. But if you roll about where I was thinking of, well, let's think about it and think about what else you're doing. And, yeah, let's have
the
some fun with it.
Roger is describing an effect number in his own unique way.
Yeah, but it's not a strict effect number. That's the thing. I'm not saying if you get the if you get the -3, you will succeed, and if you get the -2, you will not succeed.
It will be no shock to anybody who's gamed with me is that I will occasionally say, roll the dice, see how you do, and I'll worry about exact numbers later.
Yeah, what Carl Wars used to call it, roll two dice and pray, as the core of its role playing system. But the thing is, this system is designed not to do that. It is designed to say, right, the GM must specify these parameters, and then if you still roll a 6, well, great. And if you roll 2 6s, even better. And the GM has nothing to say about that. I think it would help if it didn't use the silly language.
Sorry, what?
If it didn't use the silly language of position and effect level, because what this is effectively is effect level is a difficulty. this is how well you will do with a bare success. That is what effect level is. And position is downside risk. A desperate six and a controlled six are exactly the same. A desperate one is much worse than a controlled one. Now, just, you know, position is not the right term for that. I mean, I would personally call it downside risk or hazard, maybe, or something like that. But
hazard is nice, yes.
It's all, you know, Roll 20 is part of it, but the whole process is distancing. It's saying, stop telling me about you how awesome your character is being, and just roll these dice. And I mean, every game does this to some extent, but they don't all feel like it.
All right, I've got to say briefly on the mode of general game design consideration. Any system which generates the difficulty automatically, or which is where it's pre-calculated, is going to be a lot less stressful on the GM than a system like this one, where you have to make judgment calls for every little damn thing. And sometimes my players quarrel with me about my judgment calls, and sometimes I get them wrong.
Well, think of something like Call of Cthulhu or GURPS or RuneQuest. I mean, any of those systems where you basically have a skill number.
Yeah.
You can just say as a GM, okay, roll against your skill. And that is a default difficulty, which I think is, at least in GURPS, is in a moderately challenging adventure-y sort of situation, a moderately stressful situation, but, you know, you're not just shooting your gun on the range with all your friends around you. It's actually a mildly challenging task. But that is the default. The plus zero is the default for that sort of thing, which is the typical thing you do in an adventure.
Yes, and the actions of your opponent, if there's an opponent, are going to be generating their own successes or failures, and together that matrix, we've been doing it for God knows how many years now, that matrix in so many forms works to make for a flowing narrative, which this doesn't. The other break point is the end of game roundup, the downtime. The point at which the players get to recover the stress that they spent during the game session. If they've gone over their limit, they will have had bad results. And that's one of the things that ends your career. But you have to go through quite a lot of bookkeeping. Now, you have to do it for the crew. And then you have to do it for the players. And I could feel it was dragging on people's nerves. I did not dare attempt to do it later. This would be the advice I suspect almost everybody would give me. But my memory isn't good enough. And I can't. And you have to make judgments about this. How often did the player do this? How often did the player do that? And I won't remember the game the next day well enough to make those judgment calls. I had to do it at the time. And doing that sort of record keeping was the one of the main reasons I forced you all to use Roll 20. Oh, I am so ashamed.
Yeah, the game does specifically state that the personal stuff goes first, which means, you know, we've just done the mission and mentally speaking, I at least am thinking, okay, you know, the session is coming to an end. And now we have, right, well, four players waiting while three other players do their thing, and then you do your thing. Which feels harder work than it is, because it's at that mental point in the session.
When you want to be putting your feet up.
It feels to me like the sort of thing that I would traditionally blue book. Okay, probably a very old term these days, but basically one-on-one in a narrative style with the GM.
Yeah.
And
I've done by email for every other game that I'm in, but the judgment calls at the end, and it requires judgment calls from the crew as a team. Say, all right, we've improved our crew enough that we can get this benefit? Which one of the many benefits do we want? And I want you to do that. That's why I do that first, so that we can get that done. And people can drop out once their bit, their own personal bit is
done. No, we did do the personal stuff first, and the game requires that you do the personal stuff first, because some of the crew improvements come from the personal stuff.
Oh, do they? Oh, well, in my other games, I've been listening to the recordings of Scum and Villainy, which is Blades in the Dark in a sort of Star Wars-y universe. It's not quite as depressing and corrupt as the native Blades in the Dark. I was doing the crew reconciliation first, because you've got things like heat. No, and there's another reason why I was doing the crew first, because you criminals develop heat, and your individual player characters can take action to ensure that the heat dies down and the police aren't looking at you quite so fiercely. And anyway, that's the way round I did it. And it meant half an hour to 40 minutes of fiddly game-related stuff at the end of a session when, yeah, all I want to be doing as a GM is saying, right, you know how to do your ticks, email me with any queries, or here, that was good. Have three character points each, and an extra one for Deborah for getting the Naga to eat the massive flies, which is what happened last time. I hadn't thought of that, but it was beautiful.
I think the way I would like to do this, and I will confess I haven't looked into how it would work mechanically, but thematically would be something like. End of active play, make whatever judgment calls need to be made in terms of how many times did X do Y. Then go away and do the improvements by email, and then at the start of the next session, do the crew improvements.
Hmm.
Anyway. Some of the
but you agree that was a drag.
Yeah. I'm also thinking about the strong sense of you're either in character on the mission or at least somewhat detached in the downtime.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, one of the considerations was, in my case, I was a decayed noble, did your family's ruin become relevant during play? And the answer was always going to be, well, no, because I'm a vaguely competent professional and I'm not going to bring up how terrible it is that we lost all our money.
And you can
while we're on a job.
Yeah, you can. If I plunged you into infiltrating a masked ball, then I'm certain you would have come up with plenty of interesting stuff.
Fair enough.
But
this also happens. I mean, I think one of the points of friction was, you know, two of the four PCs are basically pretty darn good at fighting in whatever way, and two of us were not. And the two of us were not. The players are also of the more planning variety, and I think that was reasonably in character for the characters as well. And so we planned ways we could do the job without any fighting. And what this meant was that the fighty characters didn't get their experience ticks, because they only get their experience ticks if they have a fight.
This is true. Remind me what type of crew you were. You're thieves, basically, I think.
I've forgotten the detail of it, but effectively, yeah.
Yeah, and this falls down on me as well, because I am supposed to go with what your plans say and make your plans possible. I am not supposed, I don't know if I am supposed to work in bits that will give everybody their focus moment, everybody their spotlight, and the thing that they do well. As you say, between the planning and the needs of the players, there is a horrible gap.
Also, the mission format, and the engagement role seemed to me to have a big jump in it. So some of this is because there is a strict limit on the duration of an engagement, or of a caper, I should say.
Yeah.
Because basically, we've only got a limited amount of stress, and when we run out of it, we're not going to be any use. So we got to get it done.
Yeah.
Before that happens.
Saying for the listeners' benefit, you use stress to get extra dice when you really need them, to improve the effect of what your dice give you when you really need it, to resist the bad things that failure or not sufficient success will bring you.
It is the oil that you use to ease your way when you're possibly not quite up to the job, but you're going to be awesome anyway. That's fair enough.
And you pay for flashbacks with stress. It is the universal enabler, and you don't have enough of it.
Yeah, which is fine. But because there is that strict ceiling on it, and on how much of it you can use, we were going straight from this person has been kidnapped and those guys appear to have her, and then there are wavy lines and we're about to break into these guys' headquarters.
Yeah.
And I was thinking things like, well, yes, obviously it appears that these guys have her, but they're not the sort of people who do that sort of thing. Is it not more plausible that they are being used as a patsy for somebody else? I want to investigate more. But no.
They were, but, as it happens.
Yeah, but the thing is, we didn't have the time to go deeper into the investigation side of it. But, well, when I say time, I mean stress, in effect. I'm not saying the session was too short. I'm saying because of the stress limit, we didn't have the number of roles we would have needed to do a deep investigation and then bash up the right people at the end of it.
I think it's designed so that you don't spend stress on establishing what you know on the investigation phase. And this means that the investigation phase is abstracted out very largely and not, it doesn't give you what it would in any other system, an opportunity for role playing your planning and doing proper interviews on people.
Yeah, and similarly the downtime phase, because it is abstracted, doesn't really have the opportunity for doing role playing.
No. Well, the way that you relieve your stress is to go and indulge your vice. Now, your vice might be praying at the temple. Your vice might be helping the widows and orphans, or it might be getting blasted out of your mind on drink and drugs. But any other system would not abstract that down to one risky dice roll.
Mm.
And
there was never.
It produces stories, but it doesn't produce role play.
Yeah, there was never a point where I thought, "Oh, I will go and chat with my friend the witch," because that will be helpful in this situation. There was never a point where I thought, "Oh, I hope my enemy the vampire doesn't show up here, because that would be a real nuisance." Mm. Okay,
that may have been my bad GM.
I mean, obviously, I can't tell completely. I wasn't sitting there in your head while you were running it. But
that would have been very inconvenient.
Yeah, but I think part of it is we are all gamers old in wickedness, and I think we like the basic approach of playing to find out what happens, while this game wants to play to tell a story, and that's not quite the same thing. I mean, I have written stories, so have you, so has at least one of the other players. I don't know about the other two, maybe they have, maybe they haven't, but if we wanted to write a story, we would be writing a story. And
even collaboratively, we would be writing a story. I understand what you're
saying.
And
if Blades is trying to do that, I think it should be more explicit in trying to do that, because that was definitely a point of friction with us as players who take the older approach.
I think it is highly prescriptive, highly structured, and I don't know where you insert the burst of inspiration and role playing that will make things fun. I sort of admire it. I don't admire at all the way the rule book is laid out. It drives me insane, and details that turn out to be important are hidden in background descriptions and things aren't organized in a way that I recognize as being a role-playing game. And you may have heard us swearing and going through searches and yes, it wasn't a pleasant experience.
I've got one of these pieces of equipment. What does it do? The only place it's mentioned in the book is in the equipment listing where it says it's a one of these.
Yeah, I like that.
Yeah,
I should mention there are other. There are other versions of the Forged in the Dark system, which I'm sort of tempted by, but not after my experiences running the two that I've run. I was going to mention a band of Blades, which is basically you are retreating before an army of undead, some of whom used to be your friends, and you have to get back by some route or other to the castle in the mountains where the final standoff will happen. I can see that being interesting. I can see that being an intriguing setup. But I can also see the prescriptiveness of this school of game design making it dead, making it uninteresting.
I confess that I was irked by the setting. I mean, I go back and listen to earlier episodes. The first thing I believe I said about this was, the sun's gone out. Well, who's doing something about that? And what are they doing? And you put a detail like that in a setting, and I want to engage with it. And the game is not about engaging with it. The game is, it's always dark in the city.
And that is fun because, I don't know, the fact that, is a reasonable hypothesis that everybody is in hell and you're just going to progress to a further stage of hell when you die. It feels that way.
It feels like scenery flats.
Yeah. It does.
There's a house next to a canal, but it's just a house. If we were engaging in minute detail in the grindy way that we're used to doing, we could say, well, you know, let's talk about the dripping passages. Let's talk about the algae growing up the walls because you just can't keep the thing dry. But the system wants you to say, okay, here is your challenge. Here is a guy standing in front of you with a sword. Be awesome.
Yeah.
It's okay, I want to talk briefly about Powered by the Apocalypse and specifically Monster Hearts because I have been listening to the latest iteration of the Esoteric Order of Roleplayers playing Monster Hearts.
Yeah.
This is a Powered by the Apocalypse game. It is basically you are all high school kids and you are also some sort of monster. A vampire or a werewolf or whatever.
Yeah. And you have issues.
You have issues and you may well be a horrible person, but let's play and find out. It's certainly not a game about I have these goals and I'm going to try to achieve them. It's more I'm a mixed up kid and I'm going to do some very stupid things and maybe I'll come out of it well and maybe I won't. Okay. I've talked about this occasionally before.
I hate high school games. I remember school. It wasn't that much fun.
Yeah,
I believe American schools are worse.
Probably. I've mentioned this before. I'll put it in the show notes. But the thing about it is that although it is still very abstracted, it has the standard Powered by the Apocalypse thing of, you know, you can describe what you want to do in whatever detail you like, but it comes down to, okay, I'm now going to roll one of my moves, and I've got, you know, six, maybe, of different things I can do. They are quite broad. And it's things like turn someone on or shut someone down, which in each stand for obviously a very wide range of social interactions. But it, they are still things that do the role playing elements. It guides you towards particular ways of doing things, but you can still develop the character as well, because your choice of whether you're going to do move A or move B is essentially what sort of person am I being at this moment, rather than, well, here's the thing I can do, and of the, how many stats is it? 11 other things that I could try to do, I'm rubbish at 4 of them, and the other ones simply won't work in this situation. So yeah. I guess I'm doing this. But the thing that Mozdarts is doing is, while it is powered by the apocalypse training wheels, you know, you're never going to have a complicated situation of how do we resolve this, because you've only got this limited set of ways to resolve it. It does at least make you find out what sort of person you are by choosing which thing you're going to do off that short list.
Yeah. Whereas the abilities here are... Well, you have enhanced abilities suitable to your character type, but the basic abilities are very much tactical very much what would be useful to a thief in this situation. And with some of the abilities, some of the enhanced abilities, you can be pretty awesome. But most of the time, you are trying with your friends to use the low-level, limited abilities that you have to do the set of things you set out to do.
Yeah, and the character I had was, in effect, the settings class of magician, the manipulator of ghosts and ghost energy and so on. And I never actually found a section of the book that described what you could be expected to do with that. I think I'm just expected to make it up.
No, you are expected, with the help of the GM, to make it up, as far as I can tell. The same applies to the way, which is what they hope is a non-actionable equivalent of the Force in Scum and Villainy.
Heh.
Yeah, there are some specific super things you can do with the way, even at the start, if you're a specialized character who's devoted to that. But what's going on in the background, what all the mysterious alien artifacts do, that is something is going to have to be made up, probably by the GM, because you just know that there's a mysterious artifact.
There is a
it's
thing
not like... entirely. It is an encouragement to creativity. But when you create something like that, when you create effectively a magic system, you want it to make sense.
Well,
you don't want it to be all flavour and no nourishment.
I want it to be consistent, particularly if I'm defining the things my character can do, or indeed the things I can expect other people who do the same thing to be able to do.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously I can say, oh, well, yes, I can summon a ghost and send him in to take that guy out of the fight before he even knows we're here. But I need to know if that's a thing that is broadly with it. So I was reading about this recently. Somebody was suggesting that the way you should do this, in fact, is just make a completely arbitrary proposal. And the GM then says, okay, well, that's going to be a desperate and it's going to have an effect level of this. And you think, aha, I'm being signaled that would be a hard thing to do. And then you reinvent your proposal until the GM says something you like better. And that does not sound like a style of play that I would find fun.
Yeah. On the other hand, would you find Ars Magica better when you have to go through all... God help us, the Cabal magic system in GURPS, where you have to go through great lists of correspondences and materials and what.
Well, I have played that. Effectively medieval mage with Phil Masters running it.
Yeah.
He had, I can't remember which of the mage books it was he wrote, but anyway, he clearly well immersed in the system, and this. A variant of this went into GURPS Thaumatology eventually. The basic idea of you have these levels of competence with the various things that collectively define the entire universe. And if you want to do a thing about this, about, you know, you want to lift the thing from here to go over there, that's forces or whatever. That was not as difficult in the same way, because I think we started off with examples of, okay, if you've got forces level one, if you've got anything level one, this is basically you can detect it. You could detect somebody else manipulating it, and that sort of thing. You get level two, and there were examples. Level two, you can do this. Level three, you can do this. So if I want to do a thing, I can say, okay, this sounds as if it might plausibly be within level two. That's a starting point for, is it a plausible thing for me to try?
I think that's slightly different from what I'm talking about, which is, I mean, that's at a fairly high level of abstraction. Both in the White Wolf and in the GURPS version.
Hmm.
But I'm talking about things like Ken Height's magic system for the Cabal, which he swears is much simplified from the real medieval precedents.
It's certainly a lot more consistent.
Well, could be. But you need to know, if you chew cinnamon gum, is this going to help the spell you're about to cast?
Yeah, though I've played several games which used that system of correspondences with a variety of different actual magic systems. And what it comes down to is, I want to do this, let me look through the list of things that this works with and see how many of them I can grab together right now. I mean, it became a running joke that magicians in that system have a fishing tackle box.
I would suggest lots and lots of pockets myself.
Yeah.
And a good system for filing what you need in your pockets, and a good sense of touch. I'm sure that's fun, but I'm also sure that you could make the let's see what we can stuff into the magic system this week, which seems to be what Blades in the Dark and Scum and Villainy are doing. I'm sure you could make that fun as well. It's just more difficult And players have got a certain right to expect to say, if they say to the GM, if I do this, does it do that? And they feel that they know what happens if you shoot a pistol or swing a sword, but they falter and go all shy when it goes off into the mystical stuff, and I don't entirely blame them.
Well, yeah, it's not just that, but, you know, I could say, all right, I will pick up a gun and fire it at somebody. There is a range of outcomes within which I can reasonably expect things to fall. You know, maybe it will malfunction, maybe I will miss, maybe I'll be able to hit them, maybe I will kill them, as it might be.
Yeah.
And when it is magic, by definition, it is anything could happen. But gaming magic tends to be... Well, no, I mean, you know, the spell will go off or the spell won't go off, and maybe you'll fumble and summon a demon, or maybe you'll do really well and not have to pay as much energy for casting the spell. But, yes, this is classic GURPS dungeon-bashing magic, or classic D&D dungeon-bashing magic, or RuneQuest, or where it has a tendency to become farming magic as well, and... It's suggested that blade sharp should really be called plough sharp, because the number of people who are using it as a plough sharpening tool are almost certainly much greater. But anyway, and that is easy to work with, because then you can say, okay, I have this capability. When do I use it? When do I spend the fatigue to do it?
Yeah.
As opposed to, oh, I could do this thing, and if it works, it will solve the entire adventure. Let's try that.
I was thinking earlier on that the modern day non-dark version of this is leverage. Leverage?
Yeah. Leverage in the States.
An obscure bit of something you might find in a salad. This is a leverage salad. There is a leverage... Leverage, oh, damn it, role-playing game.
Yeah, using the Cortex system.
Using?
Cortex system.
Which I know minimal amounts
about. You probably played it with Dr. Bob. It came out of Weiss and Hickman. It was used in the official Firefly RPG. Basically, it's a pretty conventional system, is the short version.
Yeah, and I was wondering whether that had any insights. Or any assumptions that make things work out differently. I mean, they must have a mechanism for flashbacks and post hoc planning triumphs. But I've never actually played this.
I do have a copy, but haven't used it.
Oh, well, yeah, there's a lot of those, aren't there? I think we ought to come to some sort of conclusion.
Well, what I want to do, if I were setting out to run this myself, I think I would probably go the whole hog and deploy beat analysis. Which is a thing that Robin Laws largely brought into RPGs from the TV script writing world.
I think I'm grateful.
And the basic idea is that in a linear story, where you don't have the direct involvement of everybody at the table as helping to write it, you want to have alternating beats of, you know, here is an action scene, here is a slow talky scene, here is another action scene, but also
here is a success, here is a failure, here is a failure, here is a big success.
Yeah, and things gradually go down, and then they gradually go up again, and so on. And then if you're using the save the dog prescriptive approach to script writing, sorry, save the cat, then your lowest low will be at the bottom of Act Two. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
And I think if you applied that to Blades in the Dark and said, okay, we are simply setting out to create a film script here, it would work better. Because it's halfway there, but it's not using the tools it could use to get all the way.
Contrast with Primetime Adventures, which is what I go to if I wanted that sort of feel. In fact, running Primetime Adventures within running Primetime Adventures in Duskfall or in something equivalent might actually make more sense, because you're being interested in focus time, in spotlight time. And that's what you're managing. And you get, if you're not doing it just as a one-off, you get individual episodes which focus on individual characters. Something like that you could probably bring to this system. And
I mean, I would personally rather do it in, you know, Los Angeles 1933 or something. Mm. With or without
talking about corrupt cities, yes.
Yeah, but with or without Cthulhu, but even without that, you've got the... Yeah, you know, it's always dark in the city because the scenes always happen at night. And you know, sometimes in my office there is the sun making its way through the blinds, and it's way too bright and way too hot, and I need another drink.
I'm not a vampire, not that I've noticed anyway.
But nobody needs to say, oh, well, the sun's not shining anymore, but don't worry about it.
I am not sure. It's a very bold move, but I'm not sure why they did it that way. Anyway. Okay, on the whole, do you think we've recommended this to people? I hope we've recommended it to people who will enjoy it.
Well, I mean, it is clearly not for us, not for this particular group. I have played.
I'm still playing extended games of it with another group I'm with. Maybe it's that I'm not GMing it, and that Martin's better at GMing this than I am. He's an ex-policeman. Maybe that makes a difference. But on the whole, I find that sometimes. At least with the Scum and Villainy, sometimes the players were enjoying it more than I was enjoying running it. Which is either me giving a humble brag or one of the mysteries of the universe. I'm not entirely sure which. It's peculiar. I find these games as a GM stressful to me. And I mean, I find most games stressful when it's in the early days. So,
but one of the things they're trying to do is be lower stress and particularly lower prep for the GM.
It's definitely lower prep. All I need to do have at the start of one of these capers is a description of the game as it is presented to the players. If I have a list of possible complications or things that might really be going on, then I'm probably over-preparing it. But I didn't know that you were going through the sewers to take care of the reds, of retrieving the young lady from the red sashes. That was a thing you investigated, and so I let it play out, and I let you went to the right people who would know something, and you did yourself some good with them by doing so. But it is very low prep, and if I have going in a few good ideas about what a climactic fight or struggle scene would look like. But I tried to give Dr. Bob a moment for her glory, and she turned from it because it would have been the sensible thing to do. And no, that's going into personalities. I don't know how to run this game really well, I think is what I'm saying.
I think some advice to the players would also have been helpful. I'm not saying from you, I'm saying the book should have had this, that, you know, you should not be cautious people, you should be glamorous people.
I'm not sure it doesn't say that somewhere, but most of the advice given...
I'm paranoid says that.
Most of the advice given is given to the GM. And looking back on it, that strikes me as odd and as... assuming that the GM is guiding things at a higher level than even I normally go for. So I think maybe they need to loosen up a little bit, but I can't.
Well, I think some of this is aimed at, I mean, we are always told that finding GMs is really hard, or at least finding vaguely competent GMs is really hard. And this has not generally been my experience, and most of the groups I've been in, at least half of them have at least sometimes taken a turn at GMing and been jolly good at it. But I think this is aiming at that. This is aiming to say to the GM, you don't have to be an amazing master of gaming. You can pick this thing up and you can run it, and you can go with the flow and it will work. And that's fine, but if you are an experienced GM, as obviously you are, then you will find yourself rubbing up against it. And we as experienced players found ourselves rubbing up against the edges of what the game wanted us to do.
I think there is always, with a very directed, very focused on one particular theme and topic game, there is always going to be... a point at which you rub up against its assumptions and start to think, this isn't what any sensible person would be doing. It chafed on me, and it chafed even more on some of my players. And I don't want to chafe my players. That would involve rubbing them.
I don't want to denigrate anyone, but I do think that a GM who had less of a determined personal style and players who had less determined personal styles, in other words, people, players and GM who had less experience of a variety of games, would get on with this better.
Could be. We could be getting to be old people who are trapped in our own set of assumptions. Obviously, we want to think we're getting wiser as we get older, but the evidence may be against us. All right. Shall we wrap this? We've got an hour.
Yeah, I think I would end up saying, don't not buy it because of what we have said. That I did have fun with it. I didn't particularly want to play any more of it at this point, but I would be happy to give it a go again in the future. If you can work out what its hidden assumptions are and play to them, you will probably have more fun than we did and spend more time having fun than we did. So, yeah.
Yeah. I think there are problems. I'm really grateful that I played this game because it will inform in the future any game which has a company level, as Rain calls it, any game where the base, the cores, anything like the ship, anything like that has to be managed along with the individual players.
Mm.
It will influence the way I write and run adventures. But oh, it may be too much for me. And it may be that my ability to absorb new settings is also being reduced, as well as my ability to absorb new rules.
Oh, I'm just thinking of this as the classic Traveller Free Trader campaign. You know, the caper is your misadventures on the planet, and then the company downtime stuff is the jump to the next system.
Yeah, but the jump to the next system eliminates your problems with the cops and heat and and your rivals in...
Yeah, yeah, I mean, it's a broad structure, but anyway.
All right, onwards! If you'd like to tell us about your experiences with game systems that you weren't entirely happy about, or indeed if you've got any comments about the other Forces in the Dark games like Scum and Villainy and Band of Blades.
Best of all, if you can listen to us and tell us what we were doing wrong.
We have a great deal of unfocused guilt that makes us assume that we're doing it wrong. But if not, we hope to be back sometime in the autumn, and we will see you about then. Thank you.